listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In June 1775, Boston was a city under siege in the aftermath of the events at Lexington and Concord that April. It had been cut off from supplies by a British blockade and surrounded by a colonial militia. In his latest book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, Nathaniel Philbrick describes how the Battle of Bunker Hill became the first time a skirmish between the British Army and the American colonists would lead to outright war in what would be the bloodiest battle of the Revolution. It was also the point of no return for the rebellious colonists. The book is published by Viking. I'm very pleased it has brought Nathaniel Philbrick back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be back.
And this is your 12th book. You've probably been here for at least half of those, but most of them, as I remember, were about maritime history. What inspired you to go on land here?
Well, my earlier book, Mayflower, begins with the famous Pilgrim Voyage, but the book ends 55 years later with a terrible English native conflict, King Philip's War, which ends in 1676. And it was after that, writing that book, that I realized there was a lot of deep history here, a lot of issues left unresolved that would contribute to the Revolution. I wanted to go there.
If I remember what my high school history teacher said, the American Revolutionary War began with the battles of Lexington and Concord. You argue that the official start of the war was really 3 months later with the Battle of Bunker Hill?
Well, there were a lot of people on both sides after Lexington and Concord that said, wait, these are skirmishes. Yes, there was violence. People have died. It's upsetting, and who knows where it will lead, but it's not the tipping point. We can negotiate our way out of this. It was different 60 days
later. So Bunker Hill
was
a tipping point?
Yeah, it unfolded about 60 days later, and by that time, a British army of several thousand was in Boston. Thousands of Patriot provincial soldiers, militiamen, had surrounded the city. And unlike those Lexington and Concord that were skirmishes, this was two armies meeting one another.
There are many commonly held misconceptions about the Battle of Bunker Hill. You want to go through some of them?
Well, it's called the Battle of Bunker Hill, but it was fought on a hill called Breed's Hill, and which comes from the fact that the battle began under mistaken circumstances. What the Americans wanted to do was build a fort on Bunker Hill, a larger fort on the Charlestown Peninsula, farther away from the British in Boston. But for reasons that are still unclear, the fort was built much closer, and this fomented the bloodiest battle of the Revolution.
But does anybody honor Breed's Hill as the place where the first battle of the Revolution
took
place?
Well, if you go to Boston today and see the beautiful Bunker Hill Monument, it is built on Breed's Hill. So, in fact, it says Breed's Hill on the Bunker Hill Monument, so it is totally confusing.
Wasn't the battle where the phrase, "Don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes," came from?
Yeah, there's no documentation that links that phrase. We know someone said, "Don't shoot until you see the whites of their half gaiters," but it didn't have quite the ring. But it was a phrase that it was used in battle prior to that. It could very easily have been used.
And what actually happened on that day in June 1775?
Well, it was a battle that was a kind of gruesome spectator event. All of Boston were up on their roofs watching as 2,000 British regulars were rowed from Boston to the Charlestown Peninsula and across where from Breed's Hill all the way across the peninsula to the Mystic River, the Patriots were dug in. And the British assumed that if presented with a vision of some of the finest troops in the world coming up towards them, they would turn and run, but they didn't.
How many colonists were there facing this large contingent of British soldiers?
It's a little difficult to get a number, but several thousand were on the Charlestown Peninsula.
And it's also unclear who won the battle.
Right.
Or it has been unclear, at least to me.
It has been unclear. A lot of Americans assume the Americans won the Battle of Bunker Hill. In actuality, the British, after three charges, terrible charges, whereby they lost casualties of 50%, they would take the redoubt or earthen fort on Breed's Hill and officially win the battle.
Well, what about the strategies? Could the colonists have done anything better? Could the British commanders have done anything better?
Yeah, this was a battle that is almost kind of about colonial improvisation. They put the fort on the wrong hill and realize that it's wide open to attack on their left, and they begin to make things up as they go along, build a breastwork, add what they call the rail fence, all this kind of thing. And this is happening right at the last moment as General Howe, who is leading the British forces, is trying to figure out a strategy. And as a consequence, the strategy he develops doesn't work the way he had originally intended.
But if you send enough waves of men
exactly.
after a smaller group, eventually you're going to win, even if you lose 50% of your soldiers.
And that's what happened. But as Howe said afterwards, the success is too dearly bought. And as another provincial officer said, we would be happy to sell the British another hill at the price of Breed's Hill.
Do you think if there had been a different outcome on June 17th, 1775, the war could have been avoided or at least contained a bit more?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of what-ifs. If, let's say, the British had forced the Americans into turning and running and they had just chased them into their stronghold in Cambridge and it was a total victory, it might have forced the American forces to negotiate and put an end to all this, and America would have remained part of the empire. If America, on the other hand, had not run out of gunpowder at the very end and had been able to hold the hill and have an amazing victory, the British probably would have said, let's negotiate. And the irony is, if it had gone either way, America would have perhaps still been a part of the British Empire.
Instead, the British evacuated their troops the next year. Came down to New York because they saw it as a more hospitable place?
Well, what they realized is after the Battle of Bunker Hill, this was now a war, and it was going to require a knockout blow for them to win. And strategically speaking, Boston was not the place to do it, and they needed to try somewhere to the south.
Although the title of your book is Bunker Hill, you also take the reader through the events that led up to the battle. Had the tension been building for quite some time by Lexington, Concord, and then Bunker Hill?
Yeah, Boston was a pot simmering and going to boil. The book really begins after the Boston Tea Party.
Now, was the Tea Party really an important event?
It was, in that three shiploads of tea were famously thrown into the harbor. And the important part was that England overreacted and decided that Boston must pay for this by shutting down the port commercially, even though just a hundred or so Bostonians had been involved. And this started the tensions.
Well, the Bostonians thought tea was that important. In New York, I understand, people just switched to coffee and they didn't have to pay the tax.
Yeah, people like Samuel Adams, who were the real revolutionary leaders, saw this, tried to promote this as an ideological thing and really worked it as hard as they could.
We can only wonder what it would have been like if Seattle had been part of the country at that point.
Right. Just think, we could have had the coffee wars. it would have been a very different ascent to the history. Yeah.
Well, there have been some other problems. For example, the tarring and feathering of John Malcolm, a British customs official.
Yeah,
shocking.
It is. I think a lot of us like to think of the revolution as kind of an ideological thing, and compared to other revolutions, it was not very violent. And to a certain degree, it's true. But in the streets of Boston, as tensions were building, as the city became a militarily occupied cauldron of tension, violence was erupting, and tar and feathering was not a pleasant thing to suffer.
Well, what was the reaction of the Patriot leadership to that attack?
To
the tarring and feathering.
Well,
did they welcome it?
No, they didn't, because this was just after the Tea Party, and they were trying to paint this as an ideologically driven event, not a mob action. And the tar and feathering of John Malcolm went completely against all that. And so they were upset and had tried to keep that kind of thing from not happening.
And I imagine the British were outraged.
They were. And in fact, as you see, if you look at the parliamentary records, as they're trying to figure out what to do about the Boston Tea Party, the tarring and feathering of one of their customs officials, John Malcolm, contributed to the severity of the Boston Port Act.
My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. You're talking about ideology as a factor here, but when we think about the revolution today, we see it as our forefathers' battle for freedom against tyranny and unfair taxation. You point out that the American colonists were the freest, most prosperous, and least taxed subjects of the British Empire.
Yeah. When you look at it in those terms, you go, what's their problem here? What they're objecting to is the fact that Britain is a modern empire trying to make all its colonists pay for their official upkeep, and that hasn't been happening in the past.
And the taxes were levied on the American colonists were intended as a way of paying for the army, which was there to defend them against the French. This is in the aftermath of the French and Indian Wars?
Right.
Britain borne the whole cost of the French and Indian Wars?
Pretty much. They were in debt by something like $20 billion in modern-day terms. And so the war had been fought primarily on the colonists' behalf, specifically Massachusetts.
So why did the colonists come to resent having to help pay for their own protection?
Well, they weren't used to it. It wasn't the way it had been. It's been called salutary neglect. And they said, leave us be and we will, and that's what they wanted. And the British were saying, wait a minute, you know, it's time to figure this out and make it work in an equitable way. The colonists, particularly in Massachusetts, didn't want to see it that way.
Well, when most of us think of the leaders of the revolution, we think of people like John Hancock and Samuel Adams. You chose to focus on Joseph Warren, a man that most of us haven't even heard of.
Yeah, he was a 33-year-old physician. And what was happening as the revolution was reaching that boiling point was that there was the First Continental Congress and then the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, which meant that the Patriot leadership, Samuel Adams, John Hancock, were all away in Philadelphia. And it would be left to 33-year-old Joseph Warren, a doctor with a thriving practice, a very good writer, charismatic, to lead the on-the-ground revolution, what was actually going on. And he's someone that's kind of slipped off the radar screen when it comes to our understanding of the revolution in Boston.
Wasn't he the one who dispatched Paul Revere on his famous midnight ride?
Exactly. We all know about Paul Revere, but who gave him the orders? It was Joseph Warren. He was the last Patriot leader in Boston on the night before Lexington and Concord.
Well, if he was so charismatic, should we regret the fact that he died at Bunker Hill? What might have happened if he had survived? Do you think he would have been an important voice in Philadelphia?
I think he very easily could have become one of the founding fathers we talk about. He was a major general, appointed one just prior to Bunker Hill. He would die, and I think a loyalist actually gave the highest praise, where several years later he conjectured if Joseph Warren had not died at Bunker Hill, George Washington, the loyalist claimed, would have been an obscurity, which is an interesting thing to contemplate.
Prior to the beginning of fighting between the colonists and Britain, Samuel Adams established the Boston Committee of Correspondence. How important was that organization to the revolutionary movement?
It was absolutely vital. We think of the Boston Massacre leading to the revolution, but in actuality, things had settled down in Boston until Samuel Adams comes up with the idea of the Boston Committee of Correspondence, a 21 committee that drafts open letters about the issues of the day and then sends them out to the 250 towns in Massachusetts and creates an independent communications network.
Do you see a parallel between the way this committee spread information and how people use the internet and social media during the recent uprisings in the Arab Spring?
Yeah, the technology was different, but what they were doing was turning the town meetings that every town used to determine, you know, what was going on into chat rooms, basically, where they would, instead of talking about building roads, we're talking about what's going on in Boston, what are the issues of Parliament versus our own right to be represented, those kinds of things. And this suddenly the speed of events accelerated.
I would have thought that the American Revolution is one of those stories that has been written about again and again and again. Is there anything new to be learned through research?
Well, for me, the character of Joseph Warren was an important one, but my focus was less on, I think, the traditional ways of telling the story than looking at Boston as a community in the trauma of a revolution. All my books are, in one way or another, about communities under stress. And for me, it was very instructive to see, you know, we think of this revolution as this break into the new era, when it was also a very traumatic experience for a community.
Do Bostonians see themselves as the heroes of the American Revolution because it all started in that area?
It's very important to the identity of the city.
So I've just heard that a Boston native, Ben Affleck, has optioned your book to make a film based on it?
Yeah, that's what I've heard, and I can't think of anyone in Hollywood who knows Boston better, and I think it would be an exciting prospect.
Have they invited you to participate?
It's all pretty just happening, so there haven't been any extended conversations, but I'm very excited and heartened by their interest.
Will there be big celebrations on June 17th? This is the 238th anniversary. We tend to like 200th, 225th, 250th.
Right. You know, it's not a big number necessarily, but I'm going to be there for the first time, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And are you going back to the sea for your next book?
We'll see. We'll see. The water will be in there somewhere, I'm sure.
Nathaniel Philbrick's latest book has no water other than what people drank that day. It's called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. It is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's great to be back.